Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.
Discover the power within. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with your host, Reverend Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Fort Worth in Texas. And today I welcome back to the show the always compassionate and always insightful author, poet, and storyteller, Mark Nepo. Beginning with his number one New York Times bestseller, The Book of Awakening, he has continued to produce books that have guided so many into how to live well in our contemporary world. He's been listed as one of the 100 most spiritually influential people in the world by Watkins Mind, Body, and Spirit. He's a regular columnist for Spirituality and Health magazine. And of course, many of us know him because he's regularly appearing on Oprah. Today, we're looking at his recent book, though I understand actually there's a new book coming out very soon, but we're looking at his most recent book to date, and that is More Together Than Alone, Discovering the Power and Spirit of Community in Our Lives and in Our World. If there's anything that's more apropos, I don't know what is right now in our current situation. So it's an honor, as usual, to welcome Mark Nepo to today's show. Welcome, Mark.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be back with you and be a part of your good work here.
You know, I was reading recently that, in a book actually by Karen Armstrong, you know, that she was saying that it all happened in the Renaissance, or the Renaissance, as we say in Britain, this idea of moving from, you know, the idea of a collective, of a community-based civilization to where we idolize the individual, right? And much of your book talks about that, you know, the balance between self-interest and community. We all look back to the Renaissance and say, yeah, wonderful time, you know, so many polymaths and so much that was created and developed during that time, but it came at a cost, you know?
Yeah, very much so. And so let me, you know, give a context and speak to what you bring up right away, you know, that this book is really, of all my books, it really was the most challenging to retrieve. I like to say retrieve mm-hmm. rather than author. And I'm not channeling, I'm giving it my all, and it has, you know, mm-hmm. silt from the bottom of my river, but it's really retrieving. But, you know, anyway, it took 13 years, and right. I was compelled to search out moments when we worked well together, the stories and lessons from that, to affirm the lineage of interdependence and care.
Right.
And which is there, and which is just as powerful, if not, I believe, more powerful than the destructive, dissociative, fear-based lineage. And however, it's quieter. It's much quieter. And so, you know, I think this is part of the spiritual physics, if you will, that things when they fall apart make a lot of noise. And things when they come together are quiet. Now, everything is always doing both. But one of the things about our modern global culture mm-hmm. is that I feel we are addicted to the noise of things falling apart. And so we don't need a good news station. We need a whole WHLE news station so that things can balance and complement and move forward and evolve. And, you know, when you and I were kids, I'm sure you recall, you know, when we had our three channels, the weather report was called the weather report. Now it's called Storm Watch.
Yeah, right.
last I knew, storm was only one form of weather. And so all that to say that we are at, you know, as I've looked back at all these swells in the ocean of history, there are long swells when we've pushed each other away and long swells when we've come together. And it's hard to tell where we're going at this point because of all that noise. We certainly are at a turning point, which has happened before in history. And I would just add as a beginning here to our conversation that if we look a little bit before Elizabethan, the Renaissance, we go back, and what we called in Europe the Dark Ages, which it's interesting, the rest of the world, it was a pretty enlightened time, actually, but in Europe, it was dark, and 90% of the European population was illiterate. That means 10% of the population kept literacy alive for 200 to 300 years. And if we are indeed entering a strident time, then it's incumbent on us to keep the literacy of the heart alive.
Yeah, very good point. Actually, I'm surprised it was as high as 10%, you know, because very few people could read or write back in those days. But I think the Dark Ages is a bit of a misnomer. I know we sort of categorize a huge swathe of history, you know, as the Dark Ages, which I think was laid upon it by later scholars and historians, you know, who felt that they were so much better than the Dark Age people. Whereas, in fact, you know, you look back at the Dark Ages, you see there was a mini Renaissance back in the 13th century, for instance, you know, where wonderful things were happening. And, of course, as you said, the influence of Arabic, Islamic culture, you know, was huge in Europe, in Spain, and its influence on Jewish ideas, etc. So there's always been a lot of things going on. Two things that you bring up that trigger something for me, and that is something I've thought about a lot, is up around my city, and I see how, and this is true of any city, I think, I see the organism of this city, and I see how, you know, so many disparate amounts of people and with all different attitudes, but we all get along, basically. You know, there's some violence, there's some crime, but in general, the tenor is quietly moving forward. Like you said, it's quiet. We hear the atrocities on the news, but in general, you know, the community works together well, and it works together well, not because we force it, but it's almost like it's an organic thing, right? And I think this is part of the success of something, is it must be organic. There must be an allowing of many different ways of doing things, right? And when we've got that, you know, we've got a healthier society. I was talking with somebody, I had my hair cut this morning, I was talking to somebody who was, their husband was upset with one of the American soccer players because the soccer player said she wasn't going to go to the White House, you know, if they won. I don't know if you heard that in the news.
Yes, I did.
You know, and they were saying, this is terrible, you know, you should support our country, and she doesn't want to put her hand on her heart for the flag. And I said, but listen, that's the brilliance of America. Then that's the beauty of it. You know, dissent is so important. It's wonderful if you want to honor the flag, but if you want to dishonor it in some way, if you want to stand up for something else that you think is important, then that's allowable too, right? You know, and that's the great gift. If we start saying, well, no, you must act a certain way, we've lost the higher community. We've lost that sense of, you know, of freedom, basically, of who we are as a people.
Yes, and I think that, you know, and that it's quite possible that she is honoring the flag by not going.
Yes.
That there are different responses. And so this brings up a deeper thing, which I talk about in the book, and I discovered very clearly throughout all the different cultures and throughout history, and this struggle for every person in every culture, between sameness and difference, between and so, you know, when we let fear govern us, then education becomes, we only look to confirm what we already know. And when we are looking, but education, I would offer, which is not just my thought, it's really the thought of every part of the enlightening lineage throughout time, that however much or little you know, education is about growing into what you don't know. And, you know, all we have to do is look at nature, that spring only happens because of the diversity of pollination and cross-pollination, and, you know, there are thousands of insects and birds that are each born with an inclination toward a particular nectar to carry a certain pollen and then to pollinate a particular fruit or flower or tree or bush. Now, if the bees came along and somehow could say they were fundamentalist bees, And they said, no, we're just going to do it our way.
Yeah.
Well, even if they could successfully force all of nature to do that, we'd have no spring.
Right.
And I believe this is a perfect teacher for the spring of humanity. We have no humanity if we don't welcome all paths, all viewpoints, even atheists, agnostics, whatever you want to say. We need everyone to pollinate all of humanity. Otherwise, there would be no human spring.
Right. Excellent point, isn't it? And so often, you know, just looking around us, like you say, looking at nature can bring us the deepest wisdom, you know, because you just have to look at the way the universal intelligence arranges itself, you know, to understand everything you need. I mean, we know that yoga, for instance, and other bodywork systems, you know, are based often on the movement of animals and birds and whatnot, because there's wisdom in these things, right? And I was on doing a show with Jeff Cox, who's involved with the Paul Brunton work and the publisher of Snow Lion. And we were talking about the same thing, how incredibly skillfully put together this whole universe is, right? If you say one day, oh, I think I've overcome anger, I'm not going to get angry anymore. You know, I've done the work. Then the universe will bring you a screaming row by the end of the day. You know, how does that work? It's so finely tuned. You know, the universe, the cosmic intelligence is paying close attention to each one of us. And maybe that's not such a good thing in that regard. But it is ultimately because it cares for us enough, right? To bring us forth from our what we say we're going to do to who we truly are, and that's what the universe is interested in. Is our authenticity.
Yeah. So here's a metaphor, a biological metaphor. And let me, as we're talking, offer two teachers from nature that I discovered while doing this book. So the first is it's just a very, you know, that simply the body is in a large, not precise way, but it's considered healthy as long as there's one more healthy cell than toxic. We'd like a lot more, but as long as we've got one more, then we're at least healthy and we've got a chance to push it in the health direction. Well, if we look at humanity as a global body and every soul is a cell, then everything from the work you do with your show to whatever we find wherever we're having honest conversations to the good that people are doing, the anonymous good everywhere, every day we are in the struggle to make sure humanity has one more healthy soul than toxic.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, one of the things that helps with this is these two teachers I learned, you know, that from nature, and that one is an aspen grove. And, you know, I have a chance to visit an aspen grove out in Santa Fe. And I actually learned since that the largest aspen grove is in Utah. And and it's like 160,000 acres. And it's believed to be 80,000 years old. And the thing that's so remarkable about aspen groves is that those above ground, they're individual trees.
Mm-hmm.
But underground, they share one root system. And that makes aspen groves one of the largest single living organisms on Earth. And so it's interesting that two things, when one of those trees, their part of the root system is diseased, just like in the body, how the immune system sends you know, white cells to any infection, the rest of the trees organically send healthy tissue and flow nutrients to that diseased part. And so this is, again, an incredible teacher and metaphor for community. We're walking trees. We're walking around. We are individual above surface in the day. We have, you know, we go different places. We have different unique dreams and relationships. But in the invisible soil of spirit, we have one common root system. So beyond altruism, if my roots are diseased, you have to care. We are inextricably linked.
Yes.
And another way that plays out in beautifully in nature is with birds and bird song, because we all know that birds sing at the first sign of light, which is a beautiful thing. But what I didn't know was that communally, every morning, by how they hear each other's song, they remap their community.
Mm-hmm.
Every morning,
oh, wow.
It's a new map. So they remap, oh, the chickadees over here, the mourning doves over there. Okay, my space is here. So that tells us beautifully, you have to sing your song so that you can take part and be visible and heard, so that you can take part in the remapping of accurate drawn maps of community every day. They, otherwise, you're contributing to honoring old maps. If I'm invisible, then you're, you know, you might be a grackle and say, oh, well, I guess that spot's free. I'll take that too. And it's actually a false map.
Yeah.
And so this is just amazing teachers from nature.
Yeah, you sparked a couple more ideas in me too. You know, you mentioned the trees, and I was reading in some scholarly article that you know, the micro roots of trees, even though they're not aspens and come from the same, you know, parent stock or whatever, they may be separate trees, but their micro roots connect, right? And so they communicate that way. So trees communicate with each other. Then they're still at the beginning of researching this. They're not sure how this happens, but in other words, they're not just dumb trees standing alone in the forest, you know, independent of each other. They're a community, and when something happens to one tree, there's a communication to the other, and they're sending messages. Because, you know, when I was a kid, it was like things didn't really have intelligence other than human beings. You know, they sort of had a somewhat, but now we're learning, aren't we, that everything has intelligence, right? That there's a soul within everything, and of course we've known this for hundreds and thousands of years, but we lost it in our empirical worldview, I guess. But it's lovely, the idea that, in fact, some of the most deep spiritual experiences I've had is being surrounded by trees. You know, going into the groves, and I went to the one in the redwoods in California, and they kept speaking to me, and the word they were using was peace. You know, and it wasn't the vocal word, but it was. They were breathing peace in such a way, it was more profound than going into even some of the great cathedrals. You know, it was palpable that they had a message for me, you know, in that, and for anybody that walks in there, right?
Well, you know, it's interesting because just two weeks ago, I was teaching in Santa Cruz at a retreat center, and a friend of mine took me to the Henry Cowell Redwood Forest. So I was just there.
Yeah, nice.
Some trees were 2,000 years old.
Yeah.
And exactly what you're saying, it was a natural cathedral. And the oldest, this holds the turning point of what we were just talking about, how we've lost this. So beautiful park, amazing. The oldest tree was named after a person. It was called the John Fremont tree. It should have been the tree that can't be named.
Yeah, really.
It can't be reduced to one person. And here, this is the thing where, you know, this is the same, you take the tradition where you take Columbus, who stepped foot on North America, right? And we all know there was civilization there for thousands of years, but steps foot on there and says, this is mine.
Right, I discovered it.
Right, versus, let's look at Carl Jung, who stepped foot on an unconscious continent, and his first thought was, I belong to this.
Yeah.
And there's the, you know, there's a chapter in that I'd like to just tell this story from called The Two Tribes, which is in More Together Than Alone. And, you know, as I look at all this time that we're in, and I have no answers, I'm just as, you know, flummoxed as everybody else. And, you know, I look at this and I say, how can we be here again? And yet we are. And so as I look back through all this research and all these stories, and I imagine that in the very beginning, when the first two people in cave times realized they weren't alone, like two people who were alone, and one walks to the mouth of the cave, they see someone inside and they see each other. They go, oh my God, well, I thought, who are you? And well, let's just imagine that the one in the cave points to his other and says, you're different, go away. And I think that was the beginning of the go away tribe. And depending on how much fear governs us, then there were times in history when the fear was so governing that people of that tribe would say, you know, I can't trust you'll go away, so I have to put you where I can watch you.
Right.
In a ghetto, in a camp, in a refugee center, in a detention center, on a reservation. And in the worst times, when fear has so metastasized that it governs our entire existence, then we've had horrible periods of genocide when people have said, I can't trust you at all, I have to make you go away. But if we go all the way back to the mouth of that cave, the other in the mouth saw his other and said, oh, you're different. Come teach me. Mm-hmm. That was the beginning of the come teach me tribe. Thank God you're not me. We're more together than alone.
Right.
The whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And that has led throughout history to the highest points of compassion and civilization and care. And the catch is, we belong to both tribes. And I can swear to you, I with my whole heart, that I belong to the Come Teach Me tribe, and we can get off the phone and something traumatic will happen to me tonight that'll throw me into fear, and I'll switch tribes, and I'll need you tomorrow to remind me. No, you're afraid, fine, but that's not where we live. We don't make a worldview out of that. We recover from that. We don't enshrine it. Right. And today, I think we suffer this worldwide. I think we can see that we are at this tension point. And this gets back to, you know, because I quote in the book Robert Keegan, who is a developmental psychologist at Harvard. He's done some interesting work, and he defines centrism, any kind of egocentrism, ethnocentrism, national centrism, as when we mistake what is familiar as true. That's very helpful, I think, because that explains a lot. When we stop, when we look at what's familiar and assume that that's true, then automatically anything new we say is false. And now we're saying, go away, you're different.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, and then we start confirming what we already know. We only want knowledge that will confirm and make us feel familiar, and we stop seeking truth. And this is some of the crossroads I think we're at in our world right now.
Well, it's almost a wish-fulfilling prophecy, right? Because once the world becomes scary, you know, then there's an excuse to shut down, to say, I have to go to the familiar things to protect me. And then because you do that, then that builds that sense of, you know, separation, and so on we go. So it's hard to break the pattern. You have a great quote from William James, I think, you know, when he says, most of us think we're thinking, but we're not. We're just rehearsing our prejudices, and which is the same thing about, as the, you know, the familiarity idea, isn't it? And it takes a lot of courage, though, to confront that within oneself, because, you know, generally we don't want to, you know, we don't want to humble ourselves. You know, and certainly in America, that's not the American way. We don't want to surrender, for instance. You know, I remember the great journalist and Christopher Hitchens. You know, he was an atheist, and but a brilliant man. So he could write these books about, you know, there is no God, and you'd believe them because he was able to argue so well, even if you totally disagreed with him. By the end of it, that sounds reasonable. But I remember in one of his books, he said, you know, one of the most sick things about religion is that they want you to surrender, as if surrender was, you know, this terrible thing. You know, you were giving up your autonomy, right? And and I think that's a fear for some people. You know, if they don't have me, then who? Who am I, right? Whereas the course spiritual paths invite you to go beyond you, you know, the conditioned you, in order to find the real you. But as long as you attach to your sense of self as an ego, you know, it's very, very scary, isn't it, to let go, to open to another. You know, I might be hurt, right?
Well, those are beautiful insights you raise, and I believe wholeheartedly that this is where we in the West suffer from this pride. And this self-containment, because through all the traditions have affirmed that great love and great suffering break our self-reference. Mm-hmm. And it's only at that point that the deeper journey begins, where we start to unfold and surrender. You know, the Taoist tradition, beautifully, the great image for the Taoist tradition is the fish, you know, tries to catch the current. And when it catches the current, it's a moot question. How much is it swimming on its own strength or the strength of the current? In that moment, they are one. And that the whole goal of a spiritual life on earth is to catch the current of the larger forces so that we can be at one for however long that happens. And I think this is surrender is, you know, I know, and this speaks to the difference you were saying about it's hard to let go of that self-centeredness, that containment of worldview. And I know from my own experience as a long-term cancer survivor, 30 years, 31 years now, but back in the heat of that, this was a powerful lesson for me. I was going through a very, very difficult time, and had a rib removed from my back, and 2 weeks later, I was in a Holiday Inn after my first botched chemo treatment, getting sick every 20 minutes and not knowing, well, this has got to end. This can't be, you know, my loved one, should we go to the emergency room or not? And finally we did. But before that, I'm slouched on the floor of the Holiday Inn room, scared, hurting, not knowing where this is going. And the sun started to come up. And it was not through no wisdom of mine. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, it was very clear. And I think it was grace. Grace being, I would say, not from a personalized deity, but those universal forces, mm-hmm. the current. Mm-hmm. So I was saying, yeah, what's happening to you is true. And somewhere nearby, a baby's being born. And nearby, mm-hmm. a couple's making love for the first time. And a parent and an adult child are somewhere else sitting at a table talking for the first time in a couple of years. Like, yes and yes, it's true. You know, normally when we have those insights, we'll tend to say, oh, well, then what's happening to me doesn't matter. But that's real too. And one of the, and you know, what I've learned from that, and I spent, I guess, many years unpacking that moment of grace, is that one is to be broken is no reason to see all things as broken.
Mm-hmm.
That in fact, when I'm broken, I need the company of those who know what it's like to be broken, but I need everything unbroken to heal. When I'm afraid, I need the company of those who know what it's like to be afraid, but I need everything safe to heal. This is why light, by very nature of light and dark, light fills every crack.
Yes.
That's what it does. And so I think one of the problems of our consciousness when it's run by our ego is that we tend to extrapolate our experience into a worldview. So if I'm afraid, oh, the world's a fearful place, then I teach, you know, kids that you can't trust life. You can't trust life. If I get
betrayed
by love, then I say, oh, love's, you'll find out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
yep.
How do we break through that self-reference to say, yeah, my experience is true and it's not all experience?
Let's explore that in the second segment. We're at the end of the first one right now. I'm with Mark Nepo, and we're talking about his latest book, More Together Than Alone, but also looking at vast subjects of definite concern to each one of us as alive individuals on this planet working to be part of this whole. So join us after these messages from Unity. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Discover the power within. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
If you've been inspired by the programming on Unity Online Radio, we hope you will give your support so others may be inspired too. This online radio network depends on the support of listeners like you to continue operating and expand its outreach. Go to unityonlineradio.org and click on Donate today.
Here's a Unity Mindful Moment with Eric Butterworth, taken from the live lecture, A Course in Practical Metaphysics.
Healing is the experience in our life of coming out of the darkness into the light, getting out of the confusion of human consciousness into the allness which is always present. But the allness of infinite life is present even within the illness. So God is not a healer. He doesn't look down upon you and say, well, you're sick, but you're a good person, and I like you very much, so I'm going to take this illness away from you. God doesn't take illness away from anybody, nor does God put illness into anyone, which belies a lot of traditional religious thought, too. We talk about, well, suffer to be so, it's God's will, and I guess it's my place to accept it. The will of God must always be the ceaseless longing of the Creator to express itself in that which has created. So it's a constancy, it's a force, which is ever seeking to press itself out into visibility as life, as wholeness, as success.
To find out more about Eric Butterworth, visit unity.org.
Since 1924, Daily Word has offered inspiration and practical teachings through daily prayer messages to help people of all faiths live happy, healthy lives. The magazine includes 2 months of daily affirmations, messages, articles, and spiritual poetry to help you get inspired. Subscriptions are available for print editions in large type and Spanish, as well as the digital subscription package that includes the online magazine with audio, smartphone app, and daily email. Get your subscription today. Visit dailyword.com or unity.org.
If you're looking to deepen your spiritual journey, Unity Magazine is your go-to source for information and inspiration. It's been beautifully redesigned and packed with interesting articles and compelling interviews from today's spiritual thought leaders. You'll find science, spirituality, and healing with a look at Eastern philosophies, meditation, as well as completely new ways to interpret the Bible. Plus, reviews on the latest spiritual books and music. Get a free trial issue at unitymagazine.org.
Tune into Everyday Attraction with Ray Zander every Friday at 12 p.m. Central here on Unity Online Radio. Take a deep dive into the teachings of Abraham and discover how to make the law of attraction work for you in your life. Each week, Ray goes into the heart of understanding the power of our emotions and how to become conscious co-creators. Learn how to release resistant thoughts and live life to the fullest. Find out more at everydayattraction.com.
Call now with your question or comment. 816-251-3555. That's 816-251-3555.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
So welcome back to today's show. I'm with Art Napo, and we're talking about his book, More Together Than Alone. And we ended up talking about the idea that we live in a both-and world, where there's a sort of a balance here between horror and joy, the love and fear, whatever. It's an embrace. And to me, that, you know, if there's one favorite quote of Jesus, and there's so many, because I think Jesus is the great spiritual master, and, you know, whether we consider him to be the one and only Son of God, which may or may not be true, he's definitely a great master, a great teacher. But for me, his statement to be as wise as serpents and innocent as doves is directly speaks to what we're talking about, right? That you're nobody's fool. You know, you're wise as a serpent. You use that intelligence that you have and that canny discernment. But you don't lose sight of the fact that there's an innocence within you as well, right? To be as innocent as a dove. And if you can marry those two together, you know, you're trusting, but you're not stupidly trusting. You're loving, but it's not all gooey, right? There's a strength to it. When those come together, it seems like you can live a very impeccable, or as the Buddhists call it, skillful life, you know, living from that balance.
Yeah, and you know, I think that to use another, you know, cosmic or natural, you know, metaphor as a teacher is, let's look at the relationship that's inherent in that beautiful, beautiful image from Jesus, and that's the sun. So the sun is a great teacher in that it emanates warmth and light in all directions without preference.
Right.
Yeah. So that's a great teacher. I would say that the heart is our inner sun. And I know that when I was younger, trying to be wise and protect myself, I would think that I was moving out of harm's way, let's say emotionally, but I would be shutting down my light.
Mm-hmm.
So the job of the will in the world of circumstances, yes, there are times if you're hurtful, this is what I would say, I never let that inner light stop it or muffle it. But I do have to learn the skill in the world of closing the blinds or lifting them or opening the window or shutting them if a storm's coming. That's all part of being a spirit in a body in time on earth. Mm-hmm. But mistakenly, we can muffle our light when we think we're rightfully protecting ourselves. And that is corrosive. And, you know, I think also that let's take, you know, the resources of life are whole. WHOLE. And therefore, we can't say it's understandable that from the beginning of time, human beings have wanted to separate out the difficult from the joyous and the suffering from the love. But much as we would like to, we can't. And just take a glass of water. So we all know, we learn in the seventh grade or earlier, that it's made out of H2O, hydrogen and oxygen. But I can't say to you, I'd like a glass of hydrogen, please. Because even if you could separate it, it would no longer be water and no longer be quenching. And so too the water of life. We, you know, we cannot, we need to take in all of life, because that's where the mystery and the resources and the resilience and the restorative powers of life live. And much as we it's understandable to want to separate it out, we can't. And I think that life has been made just hard enough that we need each other to ensure the journey of love.
Well, another in the analogy of water, you know, if you put a molecule of hydrogen and two molecules of oxygen together, they're not going to create water, right?
Yeah.
Just by putting them together, there's some mysterious concatenation of forces here that happens that creates water, the mysterious unknown. And I think that's true for us too. You know, when we choose to come together, well, you're a little hydrogen atom and I'm an oxygen or whatever, there's some mystery happens between us that illumines us and magnifies us when we come together, that we can't work out ourselves. You know, it's that beautiful, I think it happens in relationship, of course, when people are truly, you know, in a giving relationship, they are greater than the sum of the parts, right? And I think that happens in community too.
You know, absolutely.
Remarkable things happen that we couldn't have even imagined.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the touching story that I use in the beginning of the book, and it comes from Elie Wiesel's, you know, account as a 15-year-old in Auschwitz, his book called Night. And toward the end of the war, and of course, as inmates there, they didn't know the war was ending, but the Nazis began a death march, as they did in many places, to try to remove as much evidence that they were doing this, and the Allies were coming. And so he was part of a death march in winter, all barefoot, thousands of people in the night, and they were all, you know, told to keep moving fast, and if anyone stumbled, they would be shot. And an old man near him stumbled, and without even a thought, 15 to 20 people fell on top of him.
Mm-hmm.
In an instant. And, you know, in that horrible moment is exactly what you're talking about is, you know, they did that. They could have all been shot. They weren't. They were all just, you know, pistol whipped to get up and keep going. But they all did that so that it would be hard to tell who was the one who fell.
Right. It's a beautiful story. Yeah.
It's so touching that what is it in us under all of our, you know, that we are built. And, you know, elsewhere I've discovered and I put in the book that, you know, if you take two living heart cells, put them in a petri dish, and you and I go to lunch, when we come back, they will have found a third in common beat.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that amazing?
It is. And Irvin Laszlo, the physicist, he did experiments with meditators, which basically showed the same thing. He took two strangers, he put them in a room, and he was, you know, measuring their brain waves, and no introduction, just had them start meditating together. And within a fairly short time, they found a third common brain wave. Then he went further and he told one of them to leave, and he introduced a second or a third person, but a second stranger. And then shortly, not much longer, that person and the first person began to resume the third common brain wave. We are wired for connection. And so it leads me to, if I can, I'd love to tell this story. It's a Native American. I live in Michigan, and here the Native tribe, indigenous here, was the Ojibwe Nation, and they have like many indigenous cultures, they have a constellation of creation stories, and one of them is known as the work of the worm, and so in this story, the Great Spirit is looking how to connect everything in existence and pondering this when a little worm inches over and goes, "Hey, I can help." Well, the Great Spirit's very pleased. He says, "Well, very well, little worm, help us." So the worm goes off and starts spinning barely seeable threads from its guts. And sure enough, weaves and connects everything in existence. And you know how if you've ever seen a huge spider web, like in a barn or something, like, you know, you won't see it except when the light's on it. You know, you could walk right through it. And but when the light's on it, this golden web, and for just in that way, you couldn't see how the worm had connected everything until the Great Spirit leaned over existence. Oh, sure enough, this golden web. And oh, the Great Spirit said, "You have saved us, little worm, not by being brilliant, not by being extraordinary, by being true to your own nature. I will let you live forever." Well, and the little worm was taken back, and the Great Spirit could see this and said, leaned over and said, "Don't you want to live forever?" The little worm looked up and said, "Oh, Father, I fear so many years if I can't grow." Oh, and the Great Spirit, he just smiled at the wisdom of one of his smallest creatures. And he said, "Very, very well, little worm, I will give you this ability to spin these golden threads around yourself. And when you can stop inching and squirming and struggling, you will in time know the lightness of being that I know. Go." And so the worm went off to the nearest leaf and spun the very first cocoon and became the first butterfly. And I love that story.
Beautiful story. Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? I love these anonymous ancient stories. And why that story speaks to me, why I tell it, is because how he spun those threads from his guts, mm-hmm. not his mind, not even his heart, that says to me we cannot bypass our humanity. We have to internalize and understand, and when we do authentic inner work, we are not just doing navel gazing. We are not just doing selfish, self-contained work. When we're doing authentic inner work, we are weaving the threads that connect everything.
You know, the analogy that I read the other day was, you know, if you've tuned your guitar, And in other words, done some work on yourself, your own personal guitar, and you're in a room with another guitar that's also tuned, and you strike a note, you know, strike a chord, then the other guitar resonates with the same vibration, right? If the guitar is out of tune, then it doesn't vibrate with the other guitar. So in other words, in order for this community to happen, you know, each person must have that willingness, right, to do some inner work here, to be open to that. And but when we are, then there's, you know, and I think the person was using it in terms of meditation, or the importance of meditation is that you have to have some interior work going on for in order for you to resonate with another. And this is so true, coming back to the noise, you know, the noise in our society, where when people just, are in their own world, like we mentioned earlier, whatever that world might be, I don't want to judge it, but then they can't hear another world, right? They're familiar with what they want to, and we joke about Fox News Network and other networks, you know, the Fox News is hated by the left, and the NSNBC is hated by the right, you know, and nobody can understand, and but you know, the people that watch these shows from which we think that it's perfectly reasonable, right? When you're, you know, if you subscribe to a particular worldview. So it's really hard, isn't it, to get beyond that. There's another analogy you use, the creation of the Oxford English Dictionary, right? That was happening in the 19th century, at the very same time as the British were dominating India, you know, and you talk about the Indian mutiny in 1857, and the idea that, you know, this quote civilized nation, you know, Britain, just like America today, supposedly, you know, the white hats, you know, could be doing these atrocities while at the same time, you know, have, you know, lovely music and create great endeavors like the Oxford English Dictionary. And I think this is so true in our society, isn't it? We think we're good people, even when we're doing horrific things, you know. So how do we square that? They say that, you know, some of the Nazis, after hard day killing people, went home and listened to beautiful music and had dinner with them, you know, had a lovely time with their families, etc. This dislocation, it's tough, isn't it? Because I think we all do it to a degree, right?
Well, you know, there's
live in illusion.
Yeah, there's a great parable about two monks who study long and hard because one day they're going to keep an appointment on top of a mountain to meet Buddha. And the day comes, and they've really prepared, and halfway up the mountain, one of them breaks his leg. And so they spend the night, and in the morning, it's clear that the one who broke his leg is not doing well. He's got a fever, and it's clear it wouldn't be safe to leave him. And so the parable stops there, and the question is, what would you do? And how I read that is that when we have an era, a generation, a time, when we have more people who would keep their appointment on top of the mountain, whatever that appointment is, than to help their broken other, we are engendering an age of cruelty.
Yes.
And when we have more people who would discover that tending their broken other is the summit, we engender an age of compassion. And we, every one of us, like the two tribes, we belong to both tribes, every one of us faces this choice every day. And it doesn't matter what you put on the summit, God, eternity, wealth, security, safety, family, whatever it is. I have come to believe in my life, it's wonderful. There's nothing wrong with working toward things or wanting things. But I believe that, in my experience, that working for what we want is often an apprenticeship for working with what we're given. And that our great gifts show themselves when working with what we're given.
Yeah. Very good. I don't know if you've read David Brooks' new book called The Two Mountains.
No, I haven't. I haven't.
Yeah, it's very similar to that. You know, the first mountain is the mountain of self-interest, career, you know, being successful. And then there's the breaking down when you find that that's not the true satisfaction of your life. And you begin to climb the second mountain, which is the mountain of community and helping others and selfless action. And it's a good book. It reminds me of your books, actually, because he quotes from many sources and has lots of stories.
Oh, thank you.
But, along those lines, very, very inspiring interesting. I want to get back to a quote that you threw out, but you didn't comment on it, by Quentin Tarantino. You know, you were talking about getting beyond violence, and then you just throw out this quote, but you don't reference him in the rest of the story. But enough said, I guess, just by putting the quote out. The quote says, "There's nothing." I think something like, "There's nothing more entertaining than watching violence." And you know, if you know Quentin Tarantino's movies, you know
that's right.
He sort of glorifies violence. You know, and I'll be in a Quentin Tarantino movie, and I'm going along with it. It's very done. It's done very well, and the actors are obviously having a thoroughly good time, whatever. But then it gets to the ultimate, I mean, despicable violence for me.
Right.
And I lose it, and I just get angry. And I start getting angry and angry with Tarantino, because it's like, why? Why are you doing this? And yet he's loved, you know. He's just one of the people that can do no wrong, it seems, in Hollywood.
Well,
I just don't understand that.
Yeah, I think he's gifted, and I also, but I don't agree or find that he's using his gift toward anything that's healthy. And so I pair that quote, I believe, with a quote from Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah, you do, yeah.
About how violence is just the downfall for all of us. And why I juxtapose those is the fact that, violence is a last attempt to feel. And our need to feel never goes away. And so it'll come out sideways. And so, you know, not just Tarantino, but, you know, in a repressed, an emotionally repressed modern world, it's not by accident that we have lots of violent films, because the need to make the inside come out will not go away. And it is sublimated into violence. And, you know, even all the way back in Aristotle had this beautiful insight, which still holds up. And he said it about theater, but it applies to all forms of art. He said, we have the right to censure a piece of art if it makes us endure pity or terror without an inner necessity to do so. And that's why I think Tarantino's work and we can list other work, ultimately, as skilled as it is, it doesn't help us live.
Right.
It doesn't help us live, and therefore, we don't have to endure it if there's no inner reward for doing so. And I think that Picasso, let's take Picasso, no question, brilliant, gifted. But Picasso, at one point in his life, did 167 versions of a still life of Cézanne. You know, like, where is the inner growth? Where is the inner need to do so? And I think that the, you know, my next book, which is coming out in September, it's up now on Amazon, but Drinking from the River of Light, The Life of Expression, is all based on the notion that it's not about the beauty or the excellence of what we create. It's how we are kept alive by what comes through us. You know, that we don't, we are, right as we're talking, we're breathing. We don't say today, well, I'm just going to inhale today. No. And the way the heart breathes is we perceive and feel is the inhalation, and we must express. We must have a personal form of expression, whether it's a formal art or not. It could be gardening. It could be having dinner parties. It could be stamp collecting. But everyone has to have a way to exhale the heart, or we will be the walking dead. And when we become the walking dead, then we find violence entertaining.
Right. It's a tough one because, you know, you think about, say, the Japanese society, which is, you could say it's kind of buttoned down in some ways, you know, that they're it's very formal, but they have this subculture of, you know, anime and all that, of really strange sexual and violent magazines or whatnot, you know, and animations, and everybody watches it supposedly, right? And everybody looks at this, and they're quite happy about it, you know. So it seems like it's almost like a pressure valve, you know, that lets off steam or something.
I think this is directly related to, and again, to have compassion for it, not to judge it, but so that we can course correct it as a community, right, as a global community, but also in, and we'll find both extremes in all cultures, but also in Japan since World War II, which I mentioned in the book, out of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, they have created a tradition of creating living national treasures,
yes,
preservers of the intangible qualities of culture. That's profound. And one of the things that contributes, again, in all societies, we feel it on our own, and we've been talking about it, is that if we don't pursue an inner life, we don't have to have things figured out, but if we are not committed to an inward journey, that is, how does everything that's inside me connect to all other life, then the way water fills any hole, the existence will crush us because it will fill us like an empty hole. And this is why I think, for instance, let's take technology. Technology is inert. There's nothing wrong with technology. I love technology. Look, we're able to see each other and talk today. It's amazing. You know? But when we don't pursue an inner life of any kind, then the characteristics of technology become our default values and fill us like water filling a hole.
Right.
And this is another way to talk about this, is which I do mention in the book too, is that, you know, in Roman times, through quite strategic, intentional, deliberate action, the Colosseum was created to dissipate rebellious energy of the masses. So they'd watch lions rip up people and gladiators kill each other. But that was also that they'd be exhausted and not want a better life,
yeah,
or have the energy
problems, yeah,
to rebel
bread,
for it.
Bread and circuses, as they say.
So today, our you know, this whole reality TV culture.
It's the same idea, isn't it?
And I don't think anybody created it intentionally, but I think it's a product of our time.
Kind
it's
of like numbing.
It's a virtual Colosseum.
Yeah, it's a process along the same lines. Yeah. So, you know, the message is break free, people. You know, we're not into some kind of crazy individuality, but into the reality of us being unique but together in this. Can I do a tiny critique I don't want to be critical, but
yeah, sure.
Yeah, all right. In your book, and I take the image that you're using, and that is a big raft and little raft. You're talking about Theravada and Mahayana, you know, and it's from my understanding though of it was the Mahayana people that gave that name Mahayana and Hinayana because they thought they were better, you know, than the other guys. And the Hinayana people don't like that name. They don't like being the little vehicle or whatever. They like to call themselves Theravada, which is the way of the elders, the elder vehicle, because it was the original. But, you know, within that, there's, you know, the beautiful Metta Sutra, which talks about may all beings be happy, may love prevail throughout the universe, etc. And so, you know, although, yeah, there is an emphasis on personal enlightenment, personal salvation, whatever, there's also that sense of we're all in this together. So I just wanted to say that because it's important to know that even within that particular tradition, it's a minor thing, but I just
thank you. I appreciate it. You know, I mean, this undertaking was so vast, and I right from the start make a disclaimer that I can't possibly have gathered it all, and if I have left anything out, I appreciate, you know, thank you for adding to it. It's a conversation.
Folks, if you've not read this book, it is fascinating. I mean, there's so much in it. It's so efficacious, too, in terms of how do we come together in our fractured society. So I highly recommend it. And, of course, there's a new one now, right? What did you say it's called?
So two things I would share about, you know, which can be found on my website, smarknepo.com and threeintentions.com, all spelled out. And so the new book is Drinking from the River of Light.
I like that title.
Thank you. The Life of Expression, coming out from Sounds True in September. And also you'll find on my website, I'm offering in 2020 three spiritual journeys for small groups, no more than 30 people. And so there's a link there where you can find all the details.
Nice.
If that speaks to you, please take a look.
Let me briefly tell you about next week, and then we'll say goodbye to Mark. Next week, explorer, scholar, author, and graduate of Oxford and Columbia University's Ian A. Baker joins me. He's going to talk about his latest book, which is a lavishly illustrated guide to the principles and practices of Tibetan yoga. I just got the book a couple of weeks ago. I'm fascinated by it. It's beautiful. So as an initiate himself with 25 years spent in India and Nepal, he brings a wealth of knowledge to this subject. And so that should be a good show. But it can't be any better than the show we just had. The excellent show with Mark Nepo. And once again, thank you so much for being willing to be on World Spirituality.
Oh, thank you. It's a joy to be with you again.
All right. Blessings, folks. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Bye-bye now.
Thanks for listening. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.